Today on the Inland Journal podcast, climate change is a big part of the agenda in Olympia this year as Democratic lawmakers and Governor Inslee push for firm timetables and limits on greenhouse gas emissions. Environmental groups are supporting what they call a 100% clean electricity bill because it requires utilities by the year 2045 to sell only electricity created by renewable resources which emit no greenhouse gases. Today, we'll hear from a member of one of those environmental groups supporting the bill and from a utility that would be required to follow it. First, we hear from one of the bill's main sponsors, Seattle Democratic Senator Reuven Carlisle, just before he began taking testimony during the bill's first hearing about a month ago.
I think all of us recognize that the profound leadership of our governor around the issue of moving toward a dramatic reduction in carbon emissions, not just to meet the statutory obligations here in Washington state that we've already set, that we're on the path toward making it a serious effort, but to doubling down on every level to try to get toward the Paris Accord is a public obligation, it's a moral responsibility, and we have the type of economy that can make this happen. And so we have a sense that as we move toward the electrification of the transportation sector, as we move toward a clean energy economy, the 21st century, that the integration of wind, hydro, and solar is our future. We want to get off coal in a way that is responsible, that is has fiscal integrity to it, protecting consumers. But more than that, we know that we can move toward a renewable energy economy in a dramatic fashion that recognizes the unique nature of our state. California is moving forward, Hawaii is moving forward, states all over the country, and we have the entrepreneurial energy to build the kind of renewable energy economy that the people of the state will support. I think we have a deep sense of appreciation, the uniqueness of our commodity-based economy as number one trade state. Our timber country is incredibly important on every level to the history of the state, and they win with policies that that can really benefit from a responsible renewable energy policy, our agricultural community, and so much more. So this is an important piece of legislation that has had a number of years worth of work. Our public utilities and our private utilities are important partners in this, and we're working very hard to recognize the social justice implications, the labor implications, and the smart business implications. So a lot of work has gone into this public policy. We welcome a substantive effort at a serious public policy dialogue about this very important issue. So with that, we're extremely proud to present this legislation to you. We will make every effort to not only have an open dialogue and discourse this next period of time, but to do so in a way that allows people opportunities for amendments. I invite the minority to consider amendments and to have conversations with it about it.
That's Seattle Senator Reuven Carlisle. Brian Henning is the co-chair of 350 Spokane. That's a group that spends much of its time advocating for climate change policies. He's also the chair of the Environmental Studies Department at Gonzaga University.
If we follow the science, if we listen to what the world scientists are saying, for instance, the United Nations released a report last October saying that we've got a little more than 11 years in order to be able to dramatically reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, this bill finally aligns our policymaking, our energy production goals over the next half century with that science. And so it says we need to go to about 80% renewables by 2030. And that's very much in line with what the government scientists in our own country and internationally are saying, and then tries to achieve 100% renewable by 2045. And so it's going to be a really amazing transformation of how we produce electricity in our state.
And what are the arguments against that then?
The worries are always that it's scary to change. The worry is always that either electricity become more expensive, or that the grid will become more unreliable. These are the arguments that utilities, including Avista, frequently trot out. They did this when Washington adopted its renewable energy portfolio standard a dozen years ago. They said this will cause spikes in rates, this will make things unreliable, and the exact opposite has happened over the last 12 years, that electricity from renewables has actually made the grid more stable and has been cheaper. And I just tend to think, if you look at our engineering prowess, I never would bet against our engineers. I mean, the idea is the technology's there and ready for prime time. And so right now, for example, 14% of our electricity comes from coal in here in Spokane through Avista. And that is right now the most expensive energy on our grid. It goes down regularly. It went down for a month last summer. Whereas the wind energy doesn't have the pollution problems, is more reliable, and is far cheaper. So the renewable is not only cheaper, more reliable, and this would be the case for the rest of the state as well.
Is wind energy more reliable?
Well, it's more reliable than coal strip. I mean, we still need to finished solving our storage issues, like so that we can store some of the energy that's produced, so that when the wind is blowing, we can store some of that in some form of potential energy, either in batteries or in by moving it up a hill and letting it release to release that energy at a later date. So there are definitely storage issues which are fully resolvable, but really coal strip is such an aging plant and costs so much to keep going that it's actually just goes down regularly. So seeing it as a baseload sort of provider doesn't turn out to have been as successful. The nice thing about renewable energy is that you can make it more distributed. So if one windmill goes down, right, you've got a lot more. Same thing with solar. And the more distributed we get in our energy generation, the more we're designing our energy systems like nature itself is designed. Nature has lots of redundancies, and so that makes it more resilient. So if we have an ice storm or a windstorm or a firestorm, and you've got some energy generation at your house or in a local plant, you don't need to worry about one wire going down and then losing all of our electricity in the city.
So why put a 2030 and the 2045 deadlines on it? Why did you pick those years, and why put deadlines on it at all?
Well, the state is rightly needing to create now a law which would be enforceable. It would go beyond what Spokane did last summer, which when we committed as a city to pursuing the goal of 100% renewable by 2030. The state is creating a structure whereby this will be mandated and enforceable by law. And it needs to be done in a way that's fair to the utilities so that it can be done in a gradual way. We're at 55% renewable electricity today. So we're already more than halfway there.
Statewide?
In our grid. In statewide, it's actually a little bit farther. But in Avista's grid, we're at 55%. So we're at 45% fossil fuels in our grid. If we dropped off coal by 2025, that's 10 to 15%. So we're at about 70% by 2025.
But can you make up that 15% of electricity you lose?
Yeah, and definitely. And so the question is, what do we replace that 15% with? And what Avista wants to do is to replace it with fracked gas. And that's really our biggest concern, is because the industry has presented fracked gas as a clean alternative to coal. And it turns out that although its smokestack emissions are lower when you compare the emissions coming out of the smokestack of a coal-fired plant and out of a natural gas plant, the natural gas plant is lower. But what we're finding as we study this issue over the last half dozen years is that we need to also include the leakage rate. When you get the methane out of the ground and you transmit it through the system, you lose a good portion of the methane, usually between 1% and 3%. So if you include the leaked methane and you include the fact that the methane is a more potent greenhouse gas, if you combine those things together, it turns out that natural gas is or fracked gas is just as bad, if not worse, than the coal. So if we're going to actually design our energy system around responding to climate change, we need to not just move off coal, we need to also move off of all fossil forms of energy. And we need to do that, to answer your question about the 2030 and 2045, we need to do it in a responsible, measured way. And so we're so close to 80% as it is. This just encourages us as we transition to 2030, we drop the coal off and replace it with renewables. And then we've got that time till the middle of the century, till 2045, to get that last 20% figured out, get all the storage issues figured out. And that won't that will ensure that we don't have any spikes in rates, we don't have any spikes in, or drop off in reliability. It's a very reasonable sort of balance between aggressively pursuing what the climate science suggests we need to do and allowing the utilities to have a reasonable transformation.
Brian Henning is the co-chair of the Environmental Group 350 Spokane. At Senator Carlisle's hearing, several utility representatives acknowledged the changing energy picture, but expressed concern about details within the bill. Here's the testimony of one of those representatives.
Chair Carlisle, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Collins. I work for Pacific Power, and that is a company that serves in Yakima and Walla Walla. We appreciate the opportunity to engage with the governor and legislators on this important policy issue. Pacific Power is aggressively reducing our carbon footprint. We know our customers want more renewable energy, and we are investing billions in making that transformation. We are currently doing a significant wind project, and just 3 years ago we spearheaded an effort in Oregon called the Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Plan. We believe that by aligning the following principles, we can meet environmental goals while protecting our customers and ensuring the reliability of the electric system. These principles are, first, ensuring a reasonable glide path that allows utilities to remove carbon. Second, and very importantly, ensuring that our customers do not incur unreasonable costs. Reassessing the technology feasibility at appropriate intervals and making adjustments in compliance. Protecting the system's electric system reliability. Having a variety of tools and options for making the transformation. Relying on progressive planning strategies rather than punitive penalties, and recognition that not all utilities are alike. We thank you for the opportunity to testify. Look forward to working with the governor and the chair and the legislators to meet these shared environmental goals while protecting our customers. We will be submitting additional comments. Thank you.
Another of those utility lobbyists is John Rothlin, who is the manager of Washington Government Relations for Avista. How does Avista characterize the bill? What's Avista's position on it?
So Avista has been neutral on the bill. We have let the governor and the policymakers know we recognize the merits of transitioning to, you know, an energy industry that moves away from fossil fuel. Getting to the future that they envision is transformative. It comes with risk, but we believe we can eliminate those risks. And if we could do that, we would be in a position to get to support the bill. But we're working on some issues that that we've identified that still raise concerns for us.
So when the bill was in the Ways and Means Committee earlier this week, it was subject to a whole raft of amendments. What are some of the ways that Avista would like to see the bill changed in order to make it more palatable?
Yeah, the issues that we're dealing with are deal with cost and reliability. Those are paramount. And how do we transition, make this transition in a way that protects our customers and ensures that we're able to keep lights on and keep homes warm out into the future. Avista is working toward a clean energy profile. We've been doing that. We will continue to do that whether this bill passes or not. I think the governor and other policymakers are looking for a way to bend that emissions trajectory down. And so we're having that conversation. There are a lot of moving levers with regard to the resources and tools available to us to ensure that we keep costs down and for our customers, and that we maintain reliability. And those are the elements that we're working on with policymakers.
So Avista has been one of those companies that's been working with the sponsor of the bill. Have you liked the process? The sponsor seems to be open to amendments and that sort of thing. Is Avista satisfied with the process as it's gone on in this bill?
The process has been very open, both with the governor's office and with the legislators who are the proponents of this bill. It's moving a bit fast. We are just 5 weeks into a 105-day session, and it's already coming up for a vote on the floor soon. But we're hopeful and confident that we'll continue to have the opportunity to have input and make the bill workable.
Avista supported the city of Spokane's ordinance last year, 100% clean electricity ordinance, and Avista signed on to that. How is that different than this particular bill that's now in Olympia?
The bill here is, I think, more into the details of how this is going to work. As I mentioned, I think there's a recognition that we all want to work toward a cleaner energy future, and we're committed to doing that. The question is, how do we get it done and make sure that the provisions of what's being asked of us and the outcomes we're being asked to achieve don't unnecessarily impact customers and help us be able to keep the lights on? Those are the most important things.
I was talking with somebody today who talked about some of those companies that are wanting to phase out of coal or looking at maybe supplementing with gas through fracking and that sort of thing. Is that something Avista is looking at for its future?
Well, Avista does not do any natural gas production, so fracking or any kind of natural gas production is not part of our operations. We do distribute natural gas as part of our natural gas distribution function, and we also have natural gas generation as part of our portfolio. We also have a little bit of coal in our resource mix that continues to be a reliable and cost-effective resource for our customers. We understand that there is a move toward transitioning off of that. We understand that, and we're working on a way to make sure that we do that in a reasonable way that doesn't have maintains low costs for customers in the resources we do serve their load and make sure we're able to keep the lights on at the same time. This is a long process. We're halfway through, not even halfway through. And we're committed to trying to make this a workable policy. Again, just making sure that we protect the interests of customers, maintaining low costs, and making sure we're able to keep the lights on.
John Rothlin is manager of Washington Government Relations for Avista. Climate change advocates point to the intensity of major weather events, such as hurricanes, as proof that the patterns of weather are changing and not for the good. But it's hard for the average person to comprehend the mundane day-to-day changes. Researcher Matt Fitzpatrick from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science has created a tool he hopes will make it easier for people to understand climactic changes that scientists project over the long term. It's an interactive map of the United States that allows you to pick your city and see what its climate projections are for the year 2080.
And we often hear in the news are scientists talking about climate change, and it's often couched in terms of, you know, global averages, something like a 5 degree Fahrenheit increase in mean global temperature by year 2050. But that doesn't translate very well into people's experiences, right? We don't experience global mean temperature. We experience daily, seasonal, annual variation in weather and climate. And so the idea was to try to put the numbers in those terms, and we did that using this climate analog mapping technique.
And so how does this work?
The basic premise is we have some climate data sets for each urban area that we looked at. And so those climate data sets are measures of what we call contemporary climate, which is the average over the 30-year period, 1960 to 1990. And then we have future projections for in the vicinity of each urban area for what we call year 2080, but that is also a 30-year average. It's 2070 to 2099. And so for each urban area, what we did is we looked at the future projections and we asked what current location within our study region is most similar in terms of its climate to what we expect that city to be in 2080. And we call that its best analog.
And so in terms of confidence level, how do you feel about it?
Well, you know, these are future projections, and they're uncertain. And the way that we deal with that is we used 27 different climate models, and we used two emission scenarios, a high emissions scenario that assumes, in essence, we keep doing what we're doing and we don't change our behaviors in any way, and a reduced emission scenario that assumes emissions peak in 2040 and decline thereafter. And by using multiple emission scenarios and multiple climate models, we can look at the range of potential outcomes predicted by these models and scenarios. And when we see agreement in those, that's suggestive that the models are all telling us the same approximate thing about the climate in these locations. And it also says something about the variability when we see how the analogs are spread across space.
So I've got my laptop here, and you've got your map. So I typed in Spokane, Washington. It says the typical winter for high emissions, Spokane's climate in 2080 will feel most like today's climate near Walla Walla, Washington, which is about 150 miles to the southwest of us. And the typical winter there is about 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, 22% drier than winter in Spokane.
And actually, Spokane is a really good example. Looking at the app that you have open on your screen, the dot at the other end of the line where Walla Walla is a rather large red circle. And the size of that circle says something about how good of a match it is. Like how good of a match is Walla Walla's current climate to what we expect Spokane's to be in 2080? And a large circle means it's actually not that good of a match. So even though we can always find what is the most similar climate, it doesn't mean it's actually very similar. And in this case, what this is telling us is Walla Walla is the best match, but actually Spokane's climate in 2080 is not really going to be like anything present in the Western Hemisphere north of the equator.
In the Northwest, it looks like your models typically say that the Northwest is going to turn more like Northern California, internal California, and often more dry. There are some areas that actually look like they're going to be wetter than areas. So what about that geographic variability?
What we're reporting in the app is the climate conditions at the best analog, and we're just giving the user some information to get a sense. A lot of places in the West get wetter in some seasons and drier in others, depending on the climate forecast. Unlike the East Coast, or actually about the eastern half of the U.S., most of the cities in 2080, they're predicted to be warmer in all seasons and wetter in all seasons. But in the West, it's a lot more complicated given the topography and the variability in climate across space.
How should we use this?
Well, I think, its primary intention is for communication, and that hopefully it's a conversation starter. Possibly you could extrapolate out and say things about, is an analog a useful analog for something about infrastructure, that kind of thing. And is it useful for policy? I'm not sure. I'm not a policymaker, but I hope more than anything it's a conversation starter and people realize the magnitude of changes that we're talking about. We hear about trying to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius under the Paris Climate Accord, and I think that's often interpreted as, well, what's the big deal? It's only 1.5 degrees C. But given that that's a global average, that's a huge amount of change in climate. And so hopefully the tool translates these numbers into something that has a lot more impact in terms of communicating the magnitude and rate of changes we're expecting in the future.
Climate change is so scrutinized these days as to whether or not we, what is the consensus and all of that. In terms of all of this, where's been the pushback? This has been out for a week or so in the public. Where's been the pushback?
I haven't had much pushback, to be honest. I mean, the response has been overwhelmingly positive, save literally a handful of sort of emails, pointing out disagreement and that sort of thing. I think the tide has fully turned in favor in terms of the public knowing that climate change is a serious issue. And there will always be those dissenting voices, but they're hopefully becoming fewer and fewer.
Matt Fitzpatrick is a researcher at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. To find and subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. We'll be back next week. I'm Doug Nadvornik.